All right, joining me on the line today is Dr. Steve Henke. He is a professor of applied economics and the co-director of the Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprise at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He's also a senior fellow and director of the Troubled Currencies Project at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Dr. Henke, it's a pleasure to have you on Follow the Money Radio.
Well, it's great to be with you, Jerry.
I had read your piece on Cato, in fact, and had referenced it in a recent article that we had placed on our website, and I found it to be very interesting. Your title of the story was Syria's Annual Inflation Hits 200%. That's not something we're really hearing in the mainstream press today.
Well, it isn't, and one reason that you're not hearing it is that the official inflation rate on an annual basis is a lot lower in Syria, around 35. So 35 is very bad, of course, but not nearly as bad. Actually, now the inflation rate's running around 215% roughly in Syria. So this is what's going on in Egypt, Syria, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, Argentina. All these countries have what I term troubled currencies. That is, currencies are getting weaker by the minute almost. And as a result of that, the weak currency feeds through into inflation in these economies. And the regimes in all those countries don't really want to tell the truth about what's going on with regard to inflation, and so they don't. And so what they tell you is a lower number, and in some cases they don't report any number. Like North Korea, there is no official number. I've calculated what I think is the inflation rate, but that is not an official number. It's an objective number, and it's really quite reliable.
What data is that, Dr. Henke? I noticed you were talking about black market exchange rate data. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, what you have to do, Jerry, is it's quite easy to come up with an objective number for inflation. And what step one is that you have to look at the exchange rate with a local currency versus the U.S. dollar or gold, the euro, some recognized convertible money or money-like commodity like gold. So you get that exchange rate, and then the next step, you go through the arithmetic, which anyone can look at the Cato Institute website for the Troubled Currency Project, and you'll see how to do it and plug the numbers in. And then after the arithmetic gets done, you end up with what's called an implied inflation rate. And then that's my estimate of what's really going on with inflation at present. So in Venezuela, see, the implied inflation rate's about 241%, the annual rate, and they're reporting 39.6% is the official rate. So there's a huge gap. In Syria, which we started out on, we've got about 215% being the annual inflation rate, as I estimate it, with objective data and using a scientific approach. And the government is telling us the last data we have from them about 36.5%. In North Korea, they don't report any official number, but the annual estimate I have is around 80%.
Now, when you mention all these different countries, you're talking about countries like North Korea, Iran, Syria, Venezuela. And as I'm listening to that, I'm thinking in my mind of the old axis of evil that George Bush had once talked about. Is it just a coincidence that all of these countries are enemies of the United States and the United States dollar?
Well, in the case of North Korea and Iran and Syria, they're actually facing international sanctions. So you can draw your own conclusions from that. So you have pressure on those countries due to sanctions, and they cause the modus operandi in those countries to have to be altered and changed, and they really throw a monkey wrench into the economies. And in a place like Syria, of course, you've got a hot civil war going, raging. So that's a factor. And then Egypt, for example, the estimate that I have for inflation is about 20% per annum, and the official is just a little over 8%. So it isn't as high as the other ones, but there's some Egypt where the U.S. at least is trying to curry favor with them. So it varies a lot. It's mainly due to a very simple thing, Jerry, and that is that the government is spending so much money in those countries, and they're not able to collect taxes or access the bond market and float bond issues to finance those government expenditures. And so they go to the central bank, and they tell the central bank to, in effect, print money to finance the deficits that they have. And I can remember spent a lot of time in the 1990s in the Balkans, and in fact was the major advisor to the Yugoslav government in, from 1990 until the Civil War started in 1991. I anticipated that they would have hyperinflation because they couldn't access the international bond market. The local bond market was very, very limited, so the bonds, forget that, as a financing source for the government. And also, the tax system was withering away, and it was becoming harder and harder for them to collect taxes. So as a result, the Civil War started, and the only way they could pay for the government expenditures is to go to the central bank. The tax man couldn't generate the taxes for them, and the bond market wouldn't generate revenue for them, so they went to the central bank. And in January of 1994, the hyperinflation, that means an inflation rate of over 50% per month, the hyperinflation in Yugoslavia hit 313,000,000% in 1 month. Mm. That's 1 month.
That's 1 month.
Oh, one month, 313,000,000%. Now that was the third highest hyperinflation in the history of the world. And what was going on? The daily inflation rate then, Jerry, was 64.6%. The time required for prices to double in Yugoslavia in January of 1994, it was 1.4 days. And the price level would double on you. So how would you like to face that kind of
That's unreal.
Inflation?
Yeah, and I have a table here that I've printed out and I'm looking at, and we're going to put it up for all of our listeners so they can actually see it. A fantastic research you've done here, and it's a hyperinflation table all on one page. So many different episodes of hyperinflation, and I was surprised because I was under the impression, Doctor, that Yugoslavia back in the 90s was the worst on record, but you pointed out that the Hungary pango, the actual currency where they were actually sweeping it up in the streets back in the 40s because it was so worthless and they had switched it out. That was indeed the worst in on this table, at least. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That was July 1946. And then the numbers are just too hard to get your head around. So you have to get some kind of equivalencies. And the easiest thing is to think of it, the daily inflation rate in Hungary in 1946 at the peak was 207% per day. So it was taking 15 hours for prices to double. Less than a day, the prices would double on you. But, you know, we did have another rather recent bout of hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. That it peaked out in the middle of November 2008. And that one, the equivalent daily inflation, 98%, and it was taking just slightly over one day for prices to double.
Hmm.
And to take you down, just compare it, everyone thinks Germany is where they really had the hyperinflation in 1923. Well, they did have a hyperinflation, but the monthly rate, the peak rate, was only 29,500% per month. Now, just remember, I told you before, Yugoslavia's was 313,000,000% mm-hmm. in a month. So it is kind of mind-boggling when you look at these numbers for hyperinflation, and the only one of the countries that we've talked about so far that actually has recently had hyperinflation is Iran. And the Iranian monthly inflation was a little over 60% in October of 2012, October of last year. And then now it's settled down. Now the annual rate is about what the monthly rate was back in October of 2012. So the inflation's actually come down a lot since the peak in Iran. They're still under a lot of pressure, have lots of inflationary problems. The new government in Iran, as of course said, their top priority is to get the economy stabilized and back on its feet.
Now, when we listen to what's happening in Syria, there's been some reports put out that the Syrians have decided at the highest levels to stop all of the foreign currency use in the country, including gold, precious metals, dollars especially, which even the central bank governor had said, we want to stop this dollarization of Syria. And that's something that Iran had tried and they failed at miserably. Do you think Syria will succeed with this?
Well, only Venezuela does it too. North Korea, of course, does it. Argentina. They have exchange controls of one type or another, and there are just many ways to get around the controls, and they usually end up always failing. But the idea is, it's like a three-legged stool. You've got three things with the foreign exchange markets in these countries going on. On the one hand, you have people that use, let's say, Syria. We're talking about Syria now. So the Syrian pound. People who use a Syrian pound, they have a demand for the Syrian pound. And if they think inflation is going to get worse and the civil war is going to get worse, their expectations go negative and they reduce their demand for local currency and increase their demand for foreign currency. So that element tends to weaken the Syrian pound, make it get weaker, which means inflation is going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
So the pound gets weak, inflation goes up even higher. And sometimes you get kind of in a negative feedback loop where the thing just gets worse and worse and worse because, of course, people think things are going to get worse, and then actually the pound gets weaker, inflation goes up, and they say, oh, we were right the first time, and we look out another couple of months or a month or something, and we think it's going to get worse, so we want to dump our Syrian pound and get dollars. Now, that can be stopped or arrested if the central bank, that's the second leg of the stool, if the central bank on the supply side has lots of foreign reserves, and people are demanding foreign reserves from the demand side because they're very pessimistic and everything, and the central bank has a big supply of them, they just dump the supply in, and it stabilizes the market, and the exchange rate stays about the same, and inflation stays about the same. Now, the problem is that the Syrians have limited foreign exchange, so the central bank really is constrained and can't do that unless one of their allies fills up the foreign exchange. Now, this is what I call a sugar daddy problem. In other words, if you've got a good sugar daddy and the sugar daddy is filling up the foreign exchange all the time, the central bank can stabilize the exchange rate, the local exchange rate, just by pumping foreign reserves in and satisfying the demand for those. Now, the third leg of the stool is the foreign exchange control. That's how you started out the question. And what's the foreign exchange control trying to do? It's trying to dampen down or eliminate and extinguish the demand by local people for foreign exchange. And to the extent that it's successful, it simply conserves the foreign exchange that the central bank has. They don't have to be pumping in as much foreign exchange. In principle, can eliminate the sugar daddy problem. So that's kind of how to think about it. You've got demanders, people who want foreign exchange, and you've got the supplier being central bank, and then you've got kind of a regulator in there with these foreign exchange controls, and if they get tough enough, in some countries, you know, there are death penalties associated with, or have been historically, with people speculating in foreign exchange and being engaged in the black market activities with foreign exchange. And if the probability of you getting caught and you getting prosecuted and you being either put in jail or being shot are fairly high, it tends to dampen your enthusiasm about exchanging your Syrian pound for foreign exchange. And that conserves a foreign exchange that they don't have much of at the central bank in the first place.
My guest today is Dr. Steve Hanke. He is professor of applied economics at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's been an advisor to several governments, including Albania, Kazakhstan, and Yugoslavia. He has a resume a mile long. But one thing that I was noticing in your resume, Doctor, was back in 1998, you were named one of the top 25 most influential people, according to World Trade Magazine. You've you've been a well-known currency and commodity trader for some time, and I'm curious, as an investor, which most of our listeners are investors, as an investor, when you look out at this global economy that we're in now, where do you see profit going forward in the course of the next several years?
Well, as I look out, I see a very treacherous marketplace. So no matter what move one makes, there's quite a bit of risk. Risk is quite elevated now.
As you look forward here in the United States, do you buy into being an expert in hyperinflation, being an expert in doing case studies in all of these different countries? Do you fear something similar happening in the United States?
No. We're deflating. I mean, if you buy the analytics and the numbers to go with it, which I haven't given you the numbers, everyone's eyes would start glazing over, and you don't want to lose your listeners. The growth in the money supply is not very robust in the United States, and it's much less robust in Europe. So Europe is on the verge of going into another recession, and we have essentially, you know, very low rate of inflation in the United States, of course, depending on which measure you use and all the rest of it. And that doesn't mean that we don't have some price bubbles starting to rear their ugly heads in the United States and elsewhere, because we've got this screwy monetary policy, essentially a zero interest rate at the Federal Reserve. Now, if you do that, you run into trouble, because you get everyone trying to figure out how they can make a little higher interest rate or get a little higher yield off their investment. And the cost of borrowing, if you can borrow, is low. So they call chasing yield, the investors. So they try to look at some place where the yield is a little higher, and then they leverage up borrowing a lot of money to a total return that's a little more attractive, because they're using borrowed money, not their own equity, primarily to make the investment or speculation. And it turns out that the only way you can do that and find the yield is to be investing in things that are more risky. So the Fed has created a lot of yield chasing, a lot of risk taking that's abnormally high and unusual. And as a result, you always will find these little bubbles popping up where the markets get over-agitated. I think to some extent you're seeing that in the stock market in the United States.
My final question for you, just on a more personal note, Doctor, is as a economics professor up at the Johns Hopkins University, I'm curious, ever since this crisis really began to unfold publicly back in 2007, 2008, the economic crisis here in the United States, did you see among your students a more sincere interest in how the economy works? And did you see an increase in the number of people trying to get into economics classes there? I'm just really curious what the mindset is of current students.
I don't think the mindset generally has changed since the crisis. Let's say it was starting in January of 2009. I think since then, almost nothing has changed, except there's one thing that's changed, and that is that the prospect of getting a good job on Wall Street has gone down relative to what it was before the crisis. During the bubble days, became not only attractive, but virtually assured that you would get a very good job on Wall Street, and that has changed around. Now, for my students, it hasn't, because to take my courses, I require that the students have, out of a 4.0 grade point average, that they have a minimum of a 3.5. So I have essentially straight A students, and they all get their top pick jobs on Wall Street, basically a very rigorous training that I give them so that they actually can do something. You see, most college students now, in this day and age, they really can't do anything, especially if they're in social sciences or humanities. They're not taught how to actually do anything. So they have a little bit harder time and greater difficulty getting into the job market and kind of ramping up, because, of course, eventually everyone, once they get a job, they learn how to do something. I'm just saying that most young people don't really know how to do very much after they get out of the university, unless they've been in engineering, some of the hard sciences, or happen to have a professor that's demanding.
Right. Well, hopefully they'll learn so they can pay off those student loans that they have.
Well, yeah, that does tend to focus their
attention. Yeah, it's a little fire underneath the butt.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my guest today has been Dr. Henke, as mentioned, a professor of applied economics at the Johns Hopkins University and also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, the director of the Troubled Currencies Project. Dr. Henke, if our folks want to find out more about you and your work, how can they do so?
Go to the Cato Institute website, www.cato.org, and find the Troubled Currency page, and they certainly can find my page, and as well as other related scholars doing work that closely related to mine.
Well, we value your insight and appreciate you coming on the program today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.